Well, hello everybody, good evening, and it's a huge privilege for me to welcome Javier Cercas, a writer who I know is well known to some of you through his work, and a bonus that we have with us also his translator, Anne McLean. Javier has written a new book, which is called Anatomy of a Moment, and we'll be talking about that. It's about the attempted coup against democracy that happened in Spain 30 years ago this month. A couple of weeks' time is the 30th anniversary of that coup. And it's an exploration of exactly what happened. It's a factual book, but inflected by a novelist's imagination. And it's about the complex situation out of which the attempted coup arose, about the interconnection between politics and individual personalities, and about the question of heroism in a particular sense, a phrase coined by Hans Magnus Enzensberger, the heroism of retreat. Now, those of you who've read Soldiers of Salamis, Javier's first big book and the one which made his name throughout the world, particularly in Anne's translation, will know that the question of heroism is one which exercises the narrator very much. But in that book, it's a more direct kind of heroism. What is a hero? What does it mean to be a hero? And in both these books, one of the things that Javier is doing most fascinatingly is counterposing the Spanish right and the Spanish left, to use that very crude dichotomy. And what he's doing is showing how crude a dichotomy it is and how complex in practice, in psychology and in belief, the interrelations between the two are and how many shades there are between them. He's also the author of short stories and of a book called The Speed of Light, in which the past event that is referred to is the Vietnam War. And so in each of these three books that I've been referring to, mainly, Soldiers of Salamis, The Speed of Light, and The Anatomy of a Moment, we have the situation of a meditation some decades later on a major historical event, an attempt to understand that event and its how it works and its repercussions, but also a contemplation of the, if only implicitly, the distance between us, explicitly in Soldiers of Salamis, implicitly in the new book, of the distance between today's reader and the end writer and the event itself. What's going to happen is that Anne is going to read a passage from The Anatomy of a Moment in English, in her translation. Javier then will then read it in Spanish, so that you get a flavour of the original, whether or not you have Spanish. That will be quite short in each case, and then we'll have a bit of a conversation between us. I've got a lot of questions, or some questions I'd like to ask Javier, and which Anne may have her own take on as somebody who has that intimate relation to the texts that a translator has. But at an earlier stage, we're going to want to open things up to you and to get your questions out into the air and a conversation going. So will you join me in welcoming Anne McLean and Javier Cercas?
Okay, when I say I, you have to pretend that I am him. Anatomy of a Moment, prologue, epilogue to a novel. In the middle of March 2008, I read that according to a poll published in the United Kingdom, almost a quarter of Britons thought Winston Churchill was a fictional character. At that time, I had just finished a draft of a novel about the 23rd of February 1981 coup d'etat in Spain and was full of doubts about what I'd written. And I remember wondering how many Spaniards must think Adolfo Suarez was a fictional character, that General Gutiérrez Mellado was a fictional character, that Santiago Carrillo or Lieutenant Colonel Tejero were fictional characters. It still strikes me as a relevant question. It's true that Winston Churchill died less than 15 years ago, and as I write, Adolfo Suarez, Santiago Carrillo, and Lieutenant Colonel Tejero are still alive. But it's also true that Churchill is a top-ranking historical figure, and if Suarez might share that position, at least in Spain, General Gutierrez Mellado and Santiago Carrillo, not to mention Lieutenant Colonel Tejero, do not. Furthermore, in Churchill's time, television was not yet the main fabricator of reality, as well as the main fabricator of unreality on the planet. While one of the characteristics that defines the 23rd of February coup is that it was recorded by television cameras and broadcast all over the world. In fact, who knows whether by now Lieutenant Colonel Tejero might not be a television character to many people. Perhaps even Adolfo Suarez, General Gutierrez Mellado, and Santiago Carrillo might also be to a certain extent, but not to the extent that he is. Apart from people dressing up as him on comedy programs and advertisements, the Lieutenant Colonel's public life is confined to those few seconds repeated each year on television, in which, wearing his tricorn and brandishing his new standard-issue pistol, he bursts into the Cortes and humiliates the deputies assembled there at gunpoint. Although we know he is a real character, he is an unreal character. Although we know it is a real image, it is an unreal image. A scene from a cliché-ridden Spanish film fresh from the hackneyed brain of a mediocre imitator of Luis García Berlanga. No real person becomes fictitious by appearing on television, not even by being a television personality more than anything else. But television probably contaminates everything it touches with unreality, and the nature of an historic event alters in some way when it is broadcast on television, because television distorts, if not trivializes and demeans, the way we perceive things. The 23rd of February coup coexists with this anomaly. As far as I know, it's the only coup in history filmed for television, and the fact that it was filmed is at once its guarantee of reality and its guarantee of unreality. Added to the repeated astonishment that the images produce, to the historic magnitude of the event, and to the still troubling areas of real or assumed shadows, these circumstances might explain the unprecedented mishmash of fictions in the form of baseless theories, fanciful ideas, embellished speculations, and invented memories that surround them. Here's a tiny example of the latter. Tiny, but not banal, because it is directly related to the coup's televisual life. No Spaniard who'd reached the age of reason by the 23rd of February 1981 has forgotten his or her whereabouts that evening. And many people blessed with good memories remember in detail what time it was, where they were, with whom, having watched Lieutenant Colonel Tejero and his civil guards enter the Cortes live on television, to the point that they'd be willing to swear by what they hold most sacred that it is a real memory. It is not. Although the coup was broadcast live on radio, the television images were shown only after the liberation of the parliamentary hostages, shortly after 12:30 on the 24th, and were seen live by only a handful of Televisión Española journalists and technicians whose cameras were filming the interrupted parliamentary session and who circulated those images through the in-house network in the hope they'd be edited and broadcast on the evening news summaries and the nightly newscast. That's what happened. But we all resist having our memories removed, for they're our handle on our identity. And some put what they remember before what happened, so they carry on remembering that they watched the coup d'etat live. It is, I suppose, a neurotic reaction, though logical, especially considering the 23rd of February coup, in which it is often difficult to distinguish the real from the fictitious. After all, there are reasons to interpret the 23rd of February coup as the fruit of a collective neurosis, or of collective paranoia, or, more precisely, of a collective novel. In the society of the spectacle, it was, in any case, one more spectacle. But that doesn't mean it was a fiction. The 23rd of February coup existed, and 27 years after that day, when its principal protagonists had perhaps begun to lose for many their status as historical characters and enter the realms of fiction, I had just finished a draft of a novel in which I tried to turn the 23rd of February into fiction. And I was full of doubts.
Good evening. Let me thank the organizers of this event for inviting to me here with my translator, who improves always my books, and with Laura Brooke, who has worked hard on this translation, and take me, you know, around England, and lend me, and especially to Jeremy, who has accepted to talk to me today. And let me tell you before reading this fragment in Spanish, let me tell you the same story I told yesterday in Oxford. It's a university story. The first time Romain Jacobson, the great Russian linguistics, went to Harvard, he was welcomed by the president of the university. And he told him, the president told Jacobson, "Oh, Mr. Jacobson, somebody told me that you speak 14 languages." And Jacobson said, "Yeah, it's true, but I speak all of them in Russian." "Well, as you see, I speak English, but I speak it in Spanish. So as I speak French or Italian and Spanish. So excuse me." Anyway, this is the same. I'm going to read this in Spanish. A mediados de marzo de 2008, leí que según una encuesta publicada en el Reino Unido, la cuarta parte de los ingleses pensaba que Winston Churchill era un personaje de ficción. Por aquella época yo acababa de terminar el borrador de una novela sobre el golpe de Estado del 23 de febrero. Estaba lleno de dudas sobre lo que había escrito y recuerdo haberme preguntado cuántos españoles debían de pensar que Adolfo Suárez era un personaje de ficción, que el general Gutiérrez Mellado era un personaje de ficción, que Santiago Carrillo o el teniente coronel Tejero eran personajes de ficción. Sigue sin parecerme una pregunta impertinente. Es cierto que Winston Churchill murió hace más de 40 años, que el general Gutiérrez Mellado murió hace menos de 15 y que cuando escribo estas líneas, Adolfo Suárez, Santiago Carrillo y el teniente coronel Tejero todavía están vivos. Pero también es cierto que Churchill era un personaje de primer rango histórico y que, si bien Suárez comparte con él esa condición, al menos en España, es dudoso que lo hagan el general Gutiérrez Mellado y Santiago Carrillo, no digamos el teniente coronel Tejero. Además, en tiempos de Churchill, la televisión no era aún el principal fabricante de realidad, a la vez que el principal fabricante de irrealidad del planeta. Mientras que uno de los rasgos que define el golpe del 23 de febrero es que fue grabado por televisión y retransmitido a todo el planeta. De hecho, quién sabe si a estas alturas el teniente coronel Tejero no será, sobre todo para muchos, un personaje televisivo. Quizá incluso Adolfo Suárez, el general Gutiérrez Mellado y Santiago Carrillo lo sean en alguna medida, pero no en la misma que él. Aparte de los anuncios de grandes cadenas de electrodomésticos y las carátulas de programas de chismorreo que prodigan su estampa, la vida pública del teniente coronel golpista está confinada a los pocos segundos repetidos cada año por televisión en que, tocado con su tricornio y blandiendo su pistola reglamentaria del 9 corto, irrumpe en el hemiciclo del Congreso y humilla a tiros a los diputados reunidos allí. Aunque sabemos que es un personaje real, es un personaje irreal. Aunque sabemos que es una imagen real, es una imagen irreal. La escena de una españolada recién salida del cerebro envenenado de clichés de un mediano imitador de Luis García Berlanga. Ningún personaje real se convierte ficticio por aparecer en televisión, ni siquiera por ser sobre todo un personaje televisivo. Pero es muy probable que la televisión contamine de irrealidad cuanto toca y que un acontecimiento histórico altere de algún modo su naturaleza al ser retransmitido por televisión, porque la televisión distorsiona el modo en que lo percibimos, si es que no lo trivializa o lo degrada. El golpe del 23 de febrero convive con esa anomalía. Que yo sepa, es el único golpe en la historia grabado por televisión, y el hecho de que haya sido filmado es al mismo tiempo su garantía de realidad y su garantía de irrealidad. Sumada al asombro reiterado que producen las imágenes, a la magnitud histórica del acontecimiento y a las zonas de sombra reales o supuestas que todavía lo inquietan, esa circunstancia quizá explique el inaudito amasijo de ficciones en forma de teorías sin fundamento, de ideas fantasiosas, de especulaciones noveleras y de recuerdos inventados que lo envuelven. Pongo un ejemplo ínfimo de esto último, ínfimo pero no banal, porque guarda precisamente relación con la vida televisiva del golpe. Ningún español que tuviera uso de razón el 23 de febrero de 1981 ha olvidado su peripecia de aquella tarde, y muchas personas dotadas de buena memoria recuerdan con pormenor qué hora era, dónde estaban, con quién estaban, haber visto en directo y por televisión la entrada en el Congreso del teniente coronel Tejero y sus guardias civiles, hasta el punto de que estarían dispuestas a jurar por lo más sagrado que se trata de un recuerdo real. No lo es. Aunque la radio retransmitió en directo el golpe, las imágenes de televisión solo se emitieron tras la liberación del Congreso secuestrado, poco después de las 12:30 de la mañana del día 24, y apenas fueron contempladas en directo por un puñado de periodistas y técnicos de Televisión Española, cuyas cámaras grababan la sesión parlamentaria interrumpida y hacían circular aquellas imágenes por la red interior de la casa a la espera de ser editadas y emitidas en los avances informativos de la tarde y en el telediario de la noche. Eso fue lo que ocurrió, pero todos nos resistimos a que nos extirpen los recuerdos, que son el asidero de la identidad, y algunos anteponen lo que recuerdan a lo que ocurrió, así que siguen recordando que vieron el golpe de Estado en directo. Es, supongo, una reacción neurótica, aunque lógica, sobre todo tratándose del golpe del 23 de febrero, donde a menudo resulta difícil distinguir lo real de lo ficticio. Al fin y al cabo, hay razones para entender el golpe del 23 de febrero como el fruto de una neurosis colectiva, o de una paranoia colectiva, o más precisamente de una novela colectiva. En la sociedad del espectáculo fue, en todo caso, un espectáculo más. Pero eso no significa que fuera una ficción. El golpe del 23 de febrero existió, y 27 años después de aquel día, cuando sus principales protagonistas ya habían tal vez empezado a perder para muchos su estatuto de personajes históricos y a ingresar en el reino de lo ficticio, yo acababa de terminar el borrador de una novela en que intentaba convertir el 23 de febrero en ficción. Y estaba lleno de dudas.
Is the last word there, and but a word you will have heard coming through over and over again is real, real. Just by way of a bit of context to fill you in on the background, I mean, real is interesting here because in Spanish it means royal as well as real, and one of the characters, the main characters in this drama of the coup in 1981 was the young king, Juan Carlos, who's still the king of Spain. And just to, in very, very briefly, you know that there was a civil war in Spain in the second half of the 1930s. It was the consequence of a military coup by the old establishment of the military, the church, and the landowning aristocracy against the elected Republican government, that the nationalists, as they called themselves, the Movimiento under Franco won the civil war, and Franco stayed in power from 1939 until 1975, when he died. So that what we see in Spain is in a sense, something which began as the first act of the Second World War, in that the Italians and the Germans were involved on Franco's side, and the Soviet Union were involved on the Republican side. But in which the outcome of the Civil War was different, because Franco stayed in power, whereas Mussolini was killed and Hitler committed suicide, and in those countries, other European countries, democracy was restored in 1945. Now, democracy didn't come to Spain until after Franco's death. Franco had partly organized, or at least condoned, a transition to a monarchy in which Juan Carlos would be the king. He wasn't the natural heir to the throne, but he was a convenient person to put in place, and he proved to be a good king, and has proved to be one. But this is one of the paradoxes that is explored by Javier in his book. While there had been enormous pressure through the 50s, mounting in the 60s and 70s, towards democracy, from student radicals and dissidents who had left and were living in exile in Paris and elsewhere. The actual transition was organized, I need to read this out to you, was organized by, on the one hand, a former nationalist, a phalangist, in fact, Suarez, who was prime minister non-elected and then was elected, but who had had his whole formation as a gopher for Franco, the person who really understood how nationalism worked, how the dictatorship worked, and made it work. But then saw that the change had to happen and implemented the change. And on the other hand, Carrillo, who was the communist leader and had been a communist and indeed very active revolutionary figure in the 1930s, was a deputy for the Communist Party, but with democracy, again saw how things had to go and formed an extraordinary bond with his opposite number, Suarez. And here's a passage in which that theme is touched on and explored or intimated, as well as the theme that of history and fiction that is so much a topic that Javier writes about. This is the towards the middle of the book. History, Javier writes, fabricates strange figures. Frequently resigns itself to sentimentalism and does not disdain the symmetries of fiction. So history, that the actual raw material, the facts of history, are in a way more fictional than fiction. Who could have predicted that the change from dictatorship to democracy in Spain would not be plotted by the democratic parties, but by the phalangists and the communists, irreconcilable enemies of democracy, and each other's irreconcilable enemies during 3 years of war and 40 post-war years? Who would have predicted that the Secretary General of the Communist Party in exile would set himself up as the most faithful political ally of the last Secretary General of the Movimiento, the single fascist party? Who could have imagined that Santiago Carrillo would end up turning into an unconditional protector of Adolfo Suarez and into one of his last friends and confidants? Now, the human dimension of that in the immediate drama of the coup, which Javier writes about so brilliantly, and which provides the structure, the kind of underlying structure of the book, is that on this evening in February 1981, a middle-ranking officer came into the Cortes with a platoon of Guardia, holding a pistol over his head. And what was happening was a changeover from the prime ministership of Suarez to a new prime minister. And as soon as they came in, and everybody had been thinking there might be a coup, the entire Cortes, the parliament, dived for cover. And this, it's as if this room, suddenly there was nobody there. You look at the pictures, and the room is empty, except that over here, Suarez does not move. He stays sitting there. And over here, Carrillo, his communist opposite number, also doesn't dive for cover. Well, eventually all the others kind of shamefacedly re-emerge. And there are other aspects to this drama. But this business of the patterning of opposites coming together, this seems to be such a crucial element in how you think about the Spanish past, Javier, both in Soldiers of Salamis and in this book.
Yeah, you're right. I agree. let me to go back to this, to answer your question, which is very complex for me. Let me tell you, explain how the book began.
Yeah.
Why it is so special a book and so different. Maybe some of you have read Soldiers. So different and so similar at the same time. Because the first hint I had of this book was in 2006, was 25th anniversary of the this coup d'état, which is very important, you know, in Spanish history. That day, I was, as everybody, I'm very interested in that, because you should understand that, this is my comparison always, that this coup is like our Kennedy's assassination. This is very important. I mean, this is in a lot of sense. I'm going to go back to this. I mean, it's something like an icon of a recent history. It has been shot by television, filmed by television. It is a place in which all our historical demons are placed, you know. And there's others similarities. Anyway, I was, you know, looking at, there was, of course, plenty of things in newspapers, articles, and in the radio, and discussions, and in TV. And I saw in TV, maybe 12 o'clock, with some whiskey, because at that time I drank some a lot of whiskey. And then I was looking for to an image which is very well, I mean, it's maybe the best known image of the 20th century, which is, as you said, the civil guards entering the parliament, shooting, and these three guys staying, Santiago Carrillo, Adolfo Suárez, the president, the architect of transition, secretary of Communist Party, and also the vice president, the General Gutiérrez Mellado, which was the only military staying there. And I was fascinated by this image, as you said, of this Adolfo Suárez staying alone there. I mean, I said, wow, kind of image. I mean, it was fascinating because, first, the image alone. Second, because, well, it's logical that if they shoot you, I mean, I will go to the basement directly. I mean, of course. I mean, it was normal to die for cover, as the other guys did. And why they did that? Well, these three guys did that. Why? I mean, why precisely? And why does something, does it some meaning, this image? I insist, everybody has seen this image a lot of times in Spain and everywhere, because it was really famous. Does it some meaning? I mean, it was the question that a kid would put to himself. I love these questions. I think these are the meaningful questions. Like, why apples fall down and not fall up? You know, it's a meaningful question. So, and why precisely Suárez? Because, you know, almost instinctively, I could understand, you know, Carrillo was in the war, you know, and he had this experience, he was old, and of course, Gutiérrez Mellado was a military, and in his genes laid this, you know, can be like that. I mean, it's almost logical, his reaction, almost. Anyway, why Suárez did that? Okay, so to answer this question, not to answer this question, but to, I don't think that books, in my case, books don't answer questions, but to try to formulate this question in the most complex possible way, I began to work. And I wanted to write something like, let's say, soldiers, fiction, fact, you know, a novel with fiction and so on and so forth. I began to read everything. You know, there's a lot of books on the subject, a lot of books. I read a lot. I went to the newspapers. I talked to a lot of people. And, 2 years full-time, 10 hours a day. And at one point, 2 years later, I wrote this draft. And I said, well, one draft, maybe two drafts of this novel, and it didn't work. It just didn't ring true. So again, I thought, oh, shit, I'm a failure, as always. I'm not a writer, so let's go to holidays with the family. It was Easter. I was there, and that was when United Kingdom came to my rescue. Because I read this article, and this is the first sentence of the book, this article by Umberto Eco saying that there is this, according to a poll made in the United Kingdom, a quarter of Britons thought that Winston Churchill was a fictitious character. And I say, wait a moment. That's it. What I thought was that the coup d'etat, Spanish coup d'etat, was a collective fiction, a big fiction. During 27 years, 28 years, it has been buried, it had been buried, literally buried, by lies, half lies, funny stories, legends, crazy theories, etc., etc. Like the Kennedy's assassination, you know. And everybody has, as every American has his theory on, you know, who killed JFK, Kennedy. Everybody in Spain has his theory on who organized the coup d'etat, you know. And it is very important to say that there is not a single book written by a historian on the coup d'etat. Who wrote the history of this coup d'etat? Journalists, mainly, who worked on books, you know, like, I respect very much journalists. I mean, I write in El País, in the newspaper. But, you know, were books, irresponsible books, written in like 2 months, 3 months, you know, putting things there. And you can say whatever you want about this coup d'etat because there are no documents, no papers. You can say that the Vatican organized the coup d'etat and no problem. As you can say that JFK was killed by the Vatican and no war. Okay? It is all... So this enormous fiction, which was also, as we read, a sort of neurosis, as the Kennedy assassination was. Because, you know, we were... Franco died 75. We went, you know, 6 years of democracy. We wanted to be Europeans, you know, English and French or whatever, normal European guys. And suddenly, bam, this guy with the tricornio, like García Lorca... You know, character with the gun, it was like the devil coming. Our history, you know, in Spain, national sport is not football, as you may think. It's civil war, or if it's not possible, then coup d'état. So back again, devil's grasping us. So I said, no, this is enormous fiction. I cannot. That's the mistake I made. I can't write fiction on fiction. This is redundant. This doesn't make sense. It is literally irrelevant. It doesn't work at all. What I have to do, what is literally relevant, is unbury the complexities, the whole complexity of the coup d'état. Meaning, stick to the what I have to do is to stick to the facts. I mean, to tell just the truth. Right? So to write a non-fiction book. And that's what, finally, I tried to do. And that's what it is. I mean, this book, that explains, this is one of the reasons, one important reason, why it is not, I mean, why it's not a fiction book. You know, it's a non-fiction book. It doesn't mean, you said something that I agree absolutely. It doesn't mean, what's the result of this book? I mean, Soldiers was a weird book, but this is much more weird book. I mean, this is a horribly strange book. I understand. I mean, my publisher didn't know what to do with this book. What is this? I understand that. Because this is, in fact, in my opinion, I said this many times these days, it is an impossible book. I mean, the figure, literary figure, that is the essence of the book, is the oxymoron. You know, oxymoron is happy marriage, for instance, is an oxymoron, right? This is impossible. It's a contradiction in terms. Okay, this is the essence of this book. It's plenty of oxymorons. Because it looks for two things. I mean, I read this, I wrote this article for La Repubblica, the Italian journal, called... the article is called they asked me to write a book, an article on the book, called "The Two Truths." And what I said is that this book is looking for. I mean, I remember I recall this distinction between made by Aristotle between history and literature. He said poetry because The distinction, because the word literature didn't exist, you know, it's a new term, modern term. Anyway, so Aristotle said that there is the truth of history. The truth of history is, let's say, a factual truth, you know, journalistic truth. Looks for what happened to a certain people at a certain place, moment, at a certain place. In a certain place, factual truth, a concrete truth. That's the historical truth. On the other hand, instead, there is the literary truth, the poetical truth, says Aristotle, which is a moral truth, which is a universal truth. It looks for what has happened to everybody, to all men, at all times, at all places. So these truths, in principle, are contradictory. And this book, this crazy book, tries to mix them. I mean, tries to look for both of them at the same time. I mean, it tries to tell the story of the conquest of democracy or of the achievement of democracy in Spain, how we got democracy, through this tiny moment. I mean, the history of a country, and especially of these three main characters, Gutiérrez Mellado, Santiago Carrillo, Adolfo Suárez, of the coup d'etat, of, you know, this historical truth, to unbar it and tell this historical truth. But at the same time, it looks for, you know, a moral or a universal truth, which exactly has to do with a lot of things, mainly with power, relationship of men with power, and especially with what Enzensberger said about the heroes of treason, heroes of retreat, that I say heroes of treason. That's my, which is also a oxymoron. Heroes of treason. I mean, these three guys are, in my opinion, heroes of treason, meaning, you know, we have this good opinion of loyalty. I mean, loyalty is okay, and treason is bad. But there is something that I call ethics of treason. I mean, there are some moments in the history of people, concrete persons, and also in the history of countries, in which it's more courageous and more virtuous to treason than loyalty. And this is a perfect example of that. I mean, these three guys were traitors.
To their own causes.
Exactly. I mean, Gutiérrez Mellado, the three guys, Gutiérrez Mellado was the chief of the, he was a general, Franco's general, you know, and he was the chief of the army, Spanish army. He changed the fascist army, Franquist army, into a democratic army. And for his comrades, militaries, for the army, he was a big traitor. I mean, the biggest traitor. And he was, I mean, I've been in certain houses to talk to people who knew him, all militaries in Spain, that told me, I don't want the name of this guy pronounced in this house. Mm. I mean, he hated them, absolutely. Then
they hated him.
They hated him, sorry. Sorry for me.
He liked them.
We should all have a translator go around with us.
Yeah, that's important. Then the other one, Santiago Carrillo, also was a traitor. He was the traitor of the left because, you know, he was, as you said, you know, a communist, a Stalinist, in fact, during a long part of, great part of his life. And, you know, in the transition, he accepted democracy. He was mainly, he changed into something like a social democrat. He accepted monarchy, you know, and rejected the republic. So he was the big traitor of the left. And Suárez, the main character of the book, is the biggest traitor. I mean, the hero, absolute hero of treason is him. Because Franquist, I mean, Franquist prepared him to be the guy who could do that Frankism lived after Franco's death. I mean, 20 more years at least. And he was, you know, the perfect guy to do it, young and blah, blah, blah. And he, handsome and blah, blah, blah. And in less than a year, he made the big treason, and he changed a dictatorship for a democracy. So without this big treason, we couldn't have a freedom in Spain.
That's very, very strongly and vividly and paradoxically put, and I completely take the points you're making and think that is a great strength of the book, that it meditates on these paradoxes. And that meditative tone, this pressing at questions and asking what does this mean, is very characteristic of your writing. But to go back a notch, actually the main character of the book, you're right to describe it as a paradoxical book, and you called it an impossible book, but in essence what it is a very, very, very careful and detailed and meticulous study of what actually happened, as best you can establish it.
Exactly.
It doesn't take the physical form of a work of history. It has notes in the back, but it has no index, and that not everything is annotated. But essentially, the result of the book is to give us a more coherent account, plausible, well-grounded, of what actually happened. So it's a history book. Would that be your set as the translator? Would you agree with that, Anne?
It's a history book among other books. I think it's many books, because the structure and the form, it's set up more like a novel. A historian would never have written this book, would they?
Still, the consequence, and this is perhaps the paradox, the essence of what I want to get at, and because I want to turn to Soldiers of Salamis, if I may, is that through this fictional structure and through the novelist's wish to know not only what happened, but what it felt like and what the psychology of the main protagonists was, you arrive at a very, very detailed and satisfying account of this crisis, potential crisis, and indeed triumph of Spanish democracy, because it is a story with a wonderful ending. Everything turns out okay. Now, to go to Soldiers of Salamis, here you have two parallel narratives, again, a phalangist and possibly and a definite hero of the Republican movement, who may or may not have had some connection between them. But there you let in quite a lot more fiction.
Oh, yes.
Sánchez Mathas, the phalangist central character of the right, is a real person, and the incidents you relate about him are, as I understand it, pretty well documented. Miralles,
yeah.
the Republican resistance lead hero, who the narrator tracks down to an old people's home, and of whom the question pressing in the book is, was he the person who at a certain moment enabled the phalangist to escape with his life, is a character who, he's based on a real character who is known about through a novelist called Roberto Bolaño.
Who's a bit of a fictional character himself.
Yeah. Now,
look, the parallels between these two books are obvious, and at the same time, the differences. Because we are living with the same, in the end, we are living with the same structure. Structure is, there is a question, somebody begins a quest.
Uh-huh.
And the soldiers is, why these soldiers spared the life of Sánchez Mazas,
yeah.
Didn't kill him. In this case, in the anatomy is why Suárez stayed there,
yeah.
Instead of dying for cover. Okay, the narrator, somebody, begins a quest. And at the end of the quest, there is no answer. Because we don't know if the soldier, the journalist asks him, were you the soldier that spared the life of somebody? He says, no.
Yes.
So a blank. No. And at the end of the anatomy of a moment, we don't know. We don't know why he stayed there. There's many, 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 many speculations and many, many answers maybe. But there is no answer. So it's a quest, and the only answer is the quest itself.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So it's the only answer is the quest itself.
The quest itself.
Yeah. Exactly, the quest itself.
Yeah.
So that's the same structure. And also it's the same structure in the sense that we are dealing with a tiny point in history. The difference, tiny point, I mean, just, you know, an anecdote. There are many differences. One of them is that something is, I'm interested, as you said, not exactly, I mean, not exactly in history, but in the relationship between past and present. That's what it's interesting for me. And the fact that civil war, Spanish Civil War in the 30s, was, you know, a thing back in the past. 30s, it's a long time, I mean, I wasn't alive. My parents were kids. I mean,
this is one. Sorry to interrupt, but one of the reasons "Soldiers of Salamis" is called that is that the implication is that for the narrator, the Spanish Civil War is as remote as the Battle of Salamis.
Yeah,
it's a mythological.
Ancient history.
Yeah, exactly.
Sorry,
and then he discovers that it's not true. I mean, that past is still present. That's the main argument, maybe, the main subject. Okay, in that case, it was different because I had this tiny moment in which I tried to look for everything, to know the history of what had happened. But I arrived to a wall. Mm-hmm. Nothing, I mean, I couldn't go beyond that wall. And nobody knew anymore. So I invented. So that was, I mean, when you cannot, with journalistic or historians' skills, discover the truth, you can invent. I invented. So Miralles, for instance, Miralles is a... that's why Soldiers of Salamis has this appearance of a false chronicle. It is like a chronicle, because all these characters have their real names, but are, well, some, most of them. But even Javier Cercas, which is the main character, well, the narrator of the book. But in the end, you could invent. I mean, it was a work of fiction, even though there are, of course, a lot of parts which are historical. Instead, in the case of the anatomy of a moment, it's totally different. It's more recent, mm-hmm. and it's not a tiny, obscure point in Spanish history, but the biggest point in Spanish history, you know, the most visible and obvious and big thing. So it was different. It was different. The essence, this quest in which the sense is the quest itself, that's the same. But, you know, el fondo crea la forma. The subject creates form. That's for me very important. You can. That's the essence of maybe literature.
Yes,
and you were saying something more very important about that's. I want to. Okay. Yes.
Content.
Why? Sorry. Why?
Content.
Why? I think of this work as a kind of. I mean, when I wanted to ask this question or to formulate this question, why Suárez stayed there, and I used all my skills. I am a novelist. Essentially, I'm not a historian, so I use novelistic skills. And there are some things in this book, that's why Anne says, and I agree, that a historian could not write a book on this. Of course, he can write another book, I'm sure, better, but this book is a novelist book, in the sense that there are some things which are essentially novelistic. For instance, irony, which is the essence of the novel, in my opinion. Cervantes invented the novel as an essentially ironic genre. Or multi-perspectivism. I mean, like in Soldiers, we see from all perspectives, again and again, these moments. Here we see this moment from, you know, a lot of perspectives. That's how I conceived the book, as an experiment with history.
Yeah, that's very helpful, an experiment in history. I'd like to give you an example of this interface between history and fiction of a different kind. Because I'm English, it's sort of more empirical. One of the points that Javier made in the passage that he read and that Anne read at the beginning is that, just as some people think, apparently a lot of people think that Churchill was a fictional character, so there's this idea that people saw the coup on TV when actually they may have seen it subsequently on TV. There were TV cameras in the room in the Cortes, but what they recorded was not broadcast that night when the coup occurred. But what people did hear live on the radio was the interruption of the proceedings, which were being broadcast, and the shots that were fired by these loose-fingered Guardia. It was one of the things that went wrong with the coup, which was supposed to be a peaceful coup, was that these armed police suddenly started to loose off their guns into the ceiling of the chamber. Now, I was talking yesterday to a friend who was 17 years old in Spain when the coup occurred. And she was in a friend's house, and the radio would broadcast military music. And they said, go home, on the radio. If you're not at home, go home. There's going to be a curfew. And she went home, and on the radio she heard these shots. Now, this is where documentary and imagination start to play on each other. Because if you are expecting a coup, and you're told that a coup is happening, a martial law has come in, and then you hear shots in the Houses of Parliament, in the Cortes, you naturally imagine, don't you, that people are dead. You hear the shots. What else is it about? And that is what your mind tells you. It was not true. Nobody was killed. It's an example, I thought a very vivid example, of the interplay between the real and the fictional, the prosaic actuality, the more prosaic, they're still thrilling and complicated, that you're exploring, and how myths get created. And it's been great to have you here this evening, Javier, to explore for us and to give us such a vigorous account of the freedom of the writer in relation to these events and the way in which, different ways in which true stories can be told. Thank you very much. Will you join me in
thank you. Thank you very much. Very nice.